Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. I'm Felicia King, and you're listening to Breakfast Bites. This is part three of the Windows infrastructure auditing, and I'm going to take all of the things that were in the show as well as part two and get them updated into the website about this so that you can go to the one web page and see all of this information. I've got links out there for you for some of these articles that I've been referring you to and some of the tools as well, like the Active Directory Replication Analyzer tool. So if you go to qualityplusconsulting.com and you go to the podcasts section, you will see the podcasts for auditing Windows infrastructure, and parts 1, 2, and 3 are all going to be on the same page with the details and the links for your reference. So where we left off at the last show is I had promised you I was going to talk about manual domain controllers auditing and DHCP and Exchange. So let's get started on that. With regards to manually auditing domain controllers, what I had previously talked about domain controller-wise was we talked about DNS settings, which we talked about how that was so critically important that it be correct, and looking at the overall structure of Active Directory, OU structure, how you were applying policies, and whether or not things were in containers versus OUs. So that was really not specific on a per domain controller basis. The one thing that was specific on a per domain controller basis was where you had placed the FISMO roles. So I covered all that in part two of this. So let's talk about the things that are actually specific on a per domain controller basis that you really need to have a good handle on. And the thing I'm going to tell you here, this is something that I don't think is actually very well published by Microsoft. It's something that is known to Active Directory architects, though. And I'm going to explain the thought process behind it so that you can actually understand what's going on and why. Now, the old way that we would do things, and I say the old way because sometimes you have to... You still have to remember the concepts of the old way that you used to do things and adjust for some new circumstances or different situations and things like that. It's very important for you to understand the concepts. Okay, so imagine this. Whenever a domain controller boots up, it is registering all of its DNS-related things for Active Directory. It is registering on a dynamic basis those DNS records with the primary DNS server specified on its LAN adapter TCP/IP properties. So if domain controller 1 boots up and his primary DNS server is himself, you will probably see lots and lots of DNS-related errors when that thing boots up. Now, that doesn't mean that you necessarily have to make changes. It's just something you need to be aware of, because it may very well be that the DNS server service has not started up fully before Active Directory is booting up. And so when Active Directory is booting up, it's trying to... and that server is booting up, overall, it's trying to register its DNS records. And so there's a sequencing issue that can occur in the way that these services boot up and when records attempt to be registered. And so you can see a lot of errors in the event log associated with that. And don't be too alarmed by that, but it's also not something to completely ignore. So... Now that you know that that's how that basic mechanism worked, that that's primarily the mechanism through which these SRV and Active Directory supporting DNS records that are absolutely necessary, that's how they get into DNS, is typically through the boot up process or you cycle a bunch of services. But you need to then understand, okay, well, let's see, the last show I talked about was that if you're going to resolve issues with Active Directory, you had better make sure that you don't have DNS issues. So I'm going to give you a scenario that you can think through here. I'll give you two scenarios. One is a description of the wrong way to do it, and another is a description of the right way to do it. So the first one I'm going to tell you is the wrong way to do it. In this scenario, you have three remote domain controllers and one central domain controller. And on all four domain controllers, what you have as the primary DNS server on the TCP/IP properties for the LAN adapter on that domain controller is you have the primary DNS specified as itself. And then you have the secondary DNS server specified as the central domain controller. So when each one of these four domain controllers boots up, it will register its DNS records into itself. And then you have some sort of a replication fun time that goes on. Now the problem with this strategy is that if you're actually trying to resolve DNS record issues, what DNS server do you look at? Which one is authoritative? There aren't any that are authoritative. You need to have a configuration that you can go to one domain controller that has DNS on it, of course, and you can resolve your DNS issues there, and then you can know that all of your domain controllers are talking to it as its primary DNS, and then therefore they will all be working from the same sheet of music, and things will work when you have corrected issues in DNS that appears on server one. So the correct way to set up the TCP/IP adapter properties for the LAN adapter on a domain controller is that the primary DNS server is always going to be the central office DNS. And then the secondary should be himself, whatever the domain controller is, whatever his IP address is. And then if you actually run the best practices analyzer, it'll tell you to put loopback in there as a tertiary. That's fine. Go ahead and do that. I don't care. So this is a big issue. Again, I rarely run into an infrastructure where somebody actually knew to do this when they design all their domain controllers. And they're like, oh, well, I'll just set it up to where the remote domain controller is, he registers to himself. And their thought process with that is that that's efficient. Well, I would argue that the primary DNS server that you are sending, that you should be delivering to your workstations at that remote location, should be the closest domain controller to them. So it's probably that remote DNS server. Great. But that's the workstations. That's not the domain controller itself. So if you're trying to resolve, if you want to have the ability to quickly and rapidly and efficiently resolve Active Directory replication issues or various weird things that can happen in Active Directory, you have to control DNS, and you have to control who is the master DNS server from the perspective of all of the domain controllers. And really the only way to do that is to select a central office DNS server and have him be the primary DNS server for all the domain controllers wherever they're at. Even if it's in Myanmar. And I realize that that's going to cause some additional network traffic, but you've got to weigh the benefits versus the risks. Okay, so that's DNS in long form. Now, I've seen weird things with DNS suffix appending. So things that are being appended. This can come from two different places. In some cases, I've seen very squirrely programmed perimeter devices that are actually doing DNS suffix appending. That's very rare, but if you are finding that you are pinging something like Google, let's say you're on a domain controller and you're pinging Google, and it comes back with responding from local domain.local, then you're like, what the heck is that? You should go, what the heck is that? So at that point in time, you need to start looking at the LAN adapter properties on that domain controller and find out if there's some wonky setting either being delivered by group policy or actually specified on that server for things like DNS suffix or domain suffix appending. And if it's not happening there, then the only other place it could actually be happening is literally at the perimeter device. So then you've got to dig into that. But you see, this is one of these things that you have to look at on a per domain controller basis. You don't have any idea if some weird suffix appending is happening unless you go to the command prompt on each one of these domain controllers and actually attempt to inspect some things. And I did mention Best Practices Analyzer before. I would encourage you to actually look at that. Please do realize, though, that it is not completely 100% authoritative. It is a guideline and set of recommendations. There is one thing that you'll see it completely spaz out on, and that is it'll specify that all OUs need to be protected against accidental deletion. And I would argue that that's really your judgment call. I mean, Best Practices says to do that, but again, that's your judgment call. Now, let's talk about DHCP. DHCP, I oftentimes find is somebody has tried to be ultra too fancy with DHCP, or they've done something absolutely insane where they've decided to have a overly distributed DHCP environment, and they've got something like 50 DHCP servers. Really? You want to manage 50 DHCP servers? That doesn't sound like a good idea to me. At one point in time, I was the master of DHCP for a Fortune 500 global multinational company, and I managed all of the DHCP for the entire global infrastructure from one server. Yes. All of the DHCP requests in the entire global infrastructure for that company came back to the main office. There are pros and cons to that methodology. In that circumstance, it actually worked exceptionally well because that organization had very reliable WAN links, and it had adequate bandwidth in order to support that. So when you have highly reliable WAN links, and you have a good secondary backup plan in case, oh, say, for example, a remote connection at a remote site went down really bad. And I mean, when I say really bad, it would have to be that your dual WAN, you know, load balancing and redundancy, both of them went down, that you would then have a plan for that. Now, maybe your plan is, oh my goodness, all of the internet connections at that site are down, so do we really care about DHCP? Not so much. You know, I mean, that could be a viable plan too. You just need to think that out. So there's pros and cons for a distributed DHCP approach. Then there's a lot of pros for a centralized approach. I am a big fan of centralized DHCP, but it needs to be appropriate. It may not be the best option for an organization that has non-reliable or non-redundant branch office VPN tunnels at remote locations. So, as something to think about in your DHCP design. Now, with regards to configurations that I see that are just completely blazingly wrong, I will see things where somebody has decided to specify server-level options at this scope level. And you should, there are things in DHCP that you can specify on a per scope basis, things that have to be specified at the per scope basis. For example, your gateway for each subnet is going to be different. So therefore, that would have to be an option that's specified on a per scope basis. But your domain name, like domain.local, would need to be a server level option. Sometimes I see where there appears to be a guest subnet whose DHCP is being delivered by the primary trusted network DHCP server. Well, if that doesn't set off some alarm bells for you, I don't know what will. I mean, those two networks shouldn't be touching at all. So that should give you an idea of, oh boy, we really need to be fixing that now, because not only is that really bad from a DHCP perspective, it is astronomically horrific in terms of a network security perspective. So when you're looking at the DHCP in terms of auditing that, because that is part of the Windows infrastructure, you need to be cognizant of optimization. What are we doing for things that are done at the scope level versus what's at the server level? Are we providing name servers properly? Are there time servers being provided? That's not necessarily required. Are you providing special options that you need to? In today's day and age, if you're actually delivering WINS settings through your current DHCP, I really have to wonder what era and what century you are running your Windows infrastructure in. If you're still using WINS, you really need to rethink that. So that's another alarm bell if you see that. Now let's talk about DHCP backup and restore. This is actually very simple to accomplish, but it's also incredibly necessary that you do it, and too few people do it successfully. So I would encourage you to look up some technical articles and figure out how to back up your DHCP server configuration utilizing the Microsoft recommended technologies and techniques, and then script that and test it and test the restore on another server, and then document the process and have a plan for handling that. I would then encourage you to actually set up automated backup, so scheduled automatic backup for DHCP no less than 3 times a week. One other thing. You will oftentimes find an error message in your event logs that has to do with credentials for dynamic registrations not being specified. So if you find that, it usually is involving the set DNS credentials command. If you find that, then I would encourage you to create a special service account just for that. It should not need to be a domain admin. And then specify that utilizing the set DNS credentials command on the DHCP server. Thereby, you are giving the DHCP server service the ability to dynamically register DNS records for DHCP clients that are not doing that on their own. Now, if you don't have any clients in that infrastructure at all that have issues with dynamic registrations, then you won't see that error message. But it's important that if you do see that error message in your event log on your DHCP server, that you do handle that correctly. Now, actually, one last thing on the DHCP pools. I would highly recommend that you think about utilizing tertiary and quaternary DNS that you are server settings that you are delivering to your workstations. So let me give you this example. We talked before about the central site and remote sites, and we talked about how you specify primary and secondary DNS for your central site and your remote sites, and how I said that that's not the same as what you do for your workstations. So now I'm going to talk about what do you do for your workstations. For your workstations, their primary DNS server should always be their most local or closest DNS server in terms of a network connectivity path. Then their secondary DNS server should be the next closest. So perhaps that's the central office DNS server. And then as far as your tertiary and quaternary DNS server, I actually prefer to give out the two OpenDNS DNS servers. And that way, if the internal DNS server is down and the WAN link is down, then at least the clients can browse the internet, you know, and do things that way. However, though, that strategy will not work in a scenario where you have decided to have DNS proxy restrictions. And actually, DNS proxy restrictions is something I would encourage you to do. it sets up a scenario where only the authorized devices are able to do egress at the perimeter for port 53, whether we're talking about UDP or TCP. But anyways, it's port 53, which is DNS. This is actually reasonably important that you do this from a security perspective, because I've seen situations where there's like NAPTR type attacks, and for those of you that don't know, there's lots and lots of different types of DNS lookups. One of them seems to be used and abused is an NAPTR type attack, and there's other things like DNS reflection domain attacks, which can result in an external denial of service. And this is really no different than the strategy that you should be thinking about for your SMTP traffic as well. It's oftentimes best practice. In fact, I would argue all the time it's best practice. Sometimes you have to violate best practices. But it's all the time best practice to, at the perimeter, have a policy that says only these hosts are going to be able to egress SMTP related traffic, so 465.587.25, and I mean you could kind of bundle 110 in there, but technically that's POP 3, and generally that's not included in that bundle. And the reasoning behind all of this strategy is because if you allow just willy nilly anything on the inside of your network to egress these certain types of traffic that can be used maliciously for attacks against other parties, then this naughty traffic eventually comes back at you and causes major issues. I know of people that have had their WAN connections shut down by their internet service provider because they were not controlling the traffic that left their network, which is what egress traffic is about. So the old way of network security was just let everything leave but restrict what was coming in. Well, that is such a dead technique. I mean, that's been dead for 10 years. You need to be very serious about what is actually leaving your network as well. And so one of the ways to handle that is a DNS proxy, where you're actually checking what types of DNS requests are going out. So you're blocking an NAPTR attack. The other thing, too, is you're restricting which hosts are going to be able to communicate on an egress mode on DNS. And the same thing applies with SMTP. So that way you can reduce your risk profile for having your WAN connection destroyed and shut down and all the hassle that comes from that, because somebody was sending naughty things from the inside of your network and attacking somebody else using your network. I mean, you are legally responsible for what happens on your network, so you had better be proxying this traffic as far as I'm concerned. So, if you are going to proxy your egress DNS traffic, then adding a tertiary and a quaternary DNS server to your client workstations delivered from their DHCP lease settings, that isn't going to work, obviously. So if you actually have proper levels of security in place, that tertiary and quaternary DNS setting isn't going to work for you. And I just wanted to bring that up as something that you need to be cognizant of. Okay, let's move on to Exchange. The biggest thing that I see with Exchange is that these servers are not fully patched. There is an article out there that talks about the current Exchange patches and how to interpret the build number in general. The way that you do this is you go into Exchange Management Console. You're actually better off to go into Exchange Management Console than just doing it through Shell, because if you go into Exchange Management Shell and you issue a bunch of PowerShell commands, it tends to deliver you version information that is not directly translatable in comparison to what appears in Microsoft's technical articles about how to interpret the patch level of your Exchange server. This I find to be particularly frustrating. So I really would encourage you to not waste your time trying to mess about with those PowerShell commands. Just go into Exchange Management Console, do help and about. Oh, and there it is right there. There is your Exchange build full version number, and that is identical format to what you will find in Microsoft's technical documentation. Now, unfortunately, the current version of Microsoft's technical documentation for Exchange versions and patch level status has a couple little typos in it. So you need to be aware of that too. Ultimately, though, I would really, really encourage you to make darn sure that your Exchange server is fully, fully patched. And this is not something to be taken lightly. If you have a very large Exchange infrastructure, you obviously need to make sure that you have proper Exchange backups and a bare metal restore plan in place. Another thing to take a look at is the default SMTP email address naming policy. This is a good thing to audit because some organizations started with Cmail or Microsoft Mail or some really ancient stuff, and they've upgraded their Exchange many, 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 many times, and there can be a lot of old garbage that shows up in their SMTP email address naming policy. And those things are important to get out of there because they can actually cause some major issues. So I always revisit the default SMTP email address naming policy and determine whether or not the contents that are in there really should be there. Then I would encourage you to utilize Microsoft's Remote Connectivity Analyzer, which is testconnectivity.microsoft.com, and do a number of tests there. This will help you identify things about whether or not your certificates are set up properly on that Exchange server. Is your external auto-discover set up correctly? Do you have the right ports open? Do you have the things in place that you need to have to make ActiveSync work? You know, you've got the MRS proxy, you've got an RPC over HTTP proxy, Outlook Anywhere. There's a number of things that need to be set up properly in order to work. And in fact, there are some things that the Remote Connectivity Analyzer will not effectively test, and you do need to be aware of that. I recently ran into a situation where an organization had turned their authentication level on their MRS proxy service down to basic because they had a bunch of Mac workstations. And this is an important lesson in that oftentimes if you decide you're going to have a Mac infrastructure, if you're going to have a bunch of Mac workstations, you will probably have to be defeating and lowering the security settings in your environment in order to accommodate these systems because they just don't have the same level of capabilities. And it's very problematic. So do you have full Exchange backups set up properly? That is definitely something to check. If you find you've got 7,000 log files on your Exchange server, then that would suggest that your backups are not actually working correctly. You certainly shouldn't have that many transaction log files on your Exchange server. And then check your one-to-one NAT egress policies at the perimeter security appliance for your Exchange server. If you want that Exchange server to work properly, you need to make sure that he is always going to be talking to the internet and appearing on the internet as the same IP address, and that IP address needs to match the DNS name on the WAN side for that server. So that's something very important for you to do. You can check to find out whether or not all of your Exchange servers have the same certificate, which would need to be at least a subject alternative name certificate, because it has to respond to auto-discover and then the server name. So if it's mail.domain.com, then it would have at least those two in there. In some ways, though, you might actually want a wildcard certificate for your Exchange servers. It can make things run a little bit better. So hopefully you got all of the things that you needed to audit in your list. I do encourage you to go check out the article on my website that is the supporting piece for this three-part radio show. And again, send me your questions if you have them. It's breakfastbites@gmail.com.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by